Hello, hello. Is anyone there?
Mr. President, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
You're calling radio stations to tell people to get out and vote. What do you say to people who feel that the two parties are bought by corporations and that their vote doesn't make a difference?
There's not a shred of evidence to support that. That's what I would say. It's true that both parties have wealthy supporters, but...
It was very interesting talking to the leader of the free world.
So that's obviously an extraordinary moment. If you could talk, Tia, about the significance of this documentary coming out during the Trump administration and increasing crackdown on media in general and on independent media in particular.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I mean, look, we saw in 1996 the Telecommunication Act accelerated the consolidation of media, and that has really, you know, been chilling at this moment. There's so many journalists out there that want to report the news, that want to, you know, aggressively ask the questions, and they are compromised and they are censored and they are silenced by their own networks that are trying to curry favor with the Trump administration, with corporate sponsors. And one of the remarkable things that you know, we think of in terms of Amy's coverage over the years and Democracy Now! Is that it is not it's accountable only to its listeners. It's not accountable to corporate sponsors. It's not, you know, beholden to government funding. And that's what makes you guys really different and so refreshing right now.
And we have just 20 seconds, but talk about the significance of independently distributing this film.
Well, that's right. We're actually going to be in about 80 art house theaters across the country. They're mostly nonprofits. We are a nonprofit distribution company that's putting out this film. It is a time when, you know, Amazon, controlled by Jeff Bezos, and Paramount, you know, controlled by the Ellison family, they're not taking, you know, films like these. And so we're excited about, you know, getting it out directly to audiences, and we are looking forward to meeting folks on the road.
We're going to have to leave it there. Carl Diehl, Tia Leson, award-winning filmmakers. We all look forward to seeing the film in theaters. To find out where it's playing, go to stealthisstory.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Earth Archetypes, presenting How on Earth Live, an improv show centered on climate action at the Alberta Abbey on April 14th. Tickets and information are available at eartharchetypes.com.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:02 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Jacqueline Keeler.
Hi, are we going to have a musical interlude? Okay, I guess I'll start the show then. Good morning, Portland. It's a little after 8, and this is Jacqueline Keeler, and you're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO 90.7 FM. And I think I am live, so I'm just going to go ahead and start with the show. Normally we have a bit of music before the show starts, but I'm not hearing anything. So, yeah, we are starting this morning with a high-stakes geopolitical update. As of yesterday, a fragile two-week truce.
Sometime I believe you will. Then again, I believe you won't. Sometime I believe you will. And then again, I believe you won't. She said she would do it, but now she says she won't. That's all right. That's all right. That's all right. That's all right. If she don't, I got somebody that will.
This is Jacqueline Keeler, and you are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio. I think it's done now. Good morning, Portland. This is Jacqueline Keeler. It's 8 a.m., or it's actually 8:07 now. You're listening to a special edition of Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO 90.7 FM. And we're going to start this morning actually with a brief geopolitical update. As of yesterday, a fragile two-week truce is officially in effect between Iran and the Trump administration. Of course, we don't know how official anything is with the Trump administration at this point. But while the fighting is paused, there is something else that's just beginning. Tehran is currently advancing a Hormuz toll law through its parliament, and they are looking to charge every commercial vessel passing through the strait which carries about 20 million barrels of oil a day. They're looking at charging them each $2 million, I believe, is the amount. And there are different estimates on how much this would actually bring them. There's some estimates they could net around $1 billion a month. And they are asking this be paid, I think, in crypto. And I saw a tweet by David Stockman, a former Republican representative and also former director of the Office of Management and Budget under Reagan, and he wrote, another first-place quote-unquote win for the Donald and master negotiator of Art of the Deal fame. He writes, if Iran charges $2 million for each tanker, they will earn $280 million daily, $500 billion over 5 years in total. For comparison, $1.7 billion of cash was sent by the Obama administration to Iran, and that was part of the deal for them to stop developing uranium or nuclear power, nuclear capabilities. And of course, the present deal with Trump doesn't require that at all. And I said that the $1.7 billion in cash was actually a refund. Iran, before the revolution in the 1970s, had paid the United States $400 million for military equipment, and it was never sent. And so that was that amount plus the interest. So they're simply being refunded money they had sent the United States in the 1970s under the Shah of Iran. So that is actually a really interesting kind of development that we're seeing. We need to class it, you know, as jurisdiction as a fiscal weapon, right? If the situation holds with them being able to charge sort of a toll going through the Strait of Hormuz, which 20%, I think, of the world's oil goes through there, and also I think another 20% of the natural gas. And we were going to talk about that today, this morning, actually, jurisdiction. And this episode was originally set for last Thursday, right? There was an issue with that. A board operator got sick and we didn't have a replacement. But the news moves quite fast. And, you know, 6 days ago is quite a long time ago in the Trump news cycle. And so even so, we are circling back to last week's Supreme Court arguments in Trump v. Barbara. Why? Well, because a truce might last 2 weeks, but this nativist attempt to overturn the 14th Amendment will define the next century, could define the next century of citizenship, and also, as you will hear in the show, tribal sovereignty. I don't know if you listened to the arguments, but some interesting things were said, and whenever I hear tribes' rights or tribal citizenship being discussed at the Supreme Court, I always get a little worried. I know I've said this before about Indian federal law is a special sort of a subset of constitutional law, and it only applies to citizens of federally recognized tribes. And so whenever they're discussing those issues, it affects all federally recognized tribes. And it also affects all of us who are citizens of those tribes. We're all grouped under the same case law, and what happens to one tribe happens to all of us. And so when we hear the Supreme Court discussing us, it never goes well. It rarely goes well. And so I was quite concerned to hear the discussion going on last week. And so so the headlines were all about birthright citizenship, but the ghost in the room, and I wrote a piece actually on my Substack about that, and about the ghost in the room on this issue, and it was titled, it's on my Substack, Jacqueline Keeler's newsletter, 1884 is Calling, the Nativist Attempt to Weaponize American Indian History, and it's subtitled, Jus Sanguinis versus Jus Soli, right by blood versus right by soil, which is two different forms of citizenship, right? And the fight for the 14th Amendment. And that paragraph was, what the Solicitor General is proposing is a radical shift for jus soli, the right of the soil that has defined American belonging since the 14th Amendment's inception, to a restrictive model of jus sanguinis, or right of blood. By requiring a jurisdictional contract inherited from one's parents, the administration isn't just targeting the other, they are fundamentally changing the DNA of American citizenship itself. Okay. And so the ghost of the room in this courtroom was 1884, and thought this is a case called Elk versus Wilkins. I think it's really kind of it's interesting. This is a case actually dealing with a tribal citizen, John Elk, and he sued the Supreme Court. He sued the United States for the right to have citizenship via birthright citizenship. He was born in this country as a native person, and he was suing for the right to, because he paid taxes, he was living in Omaha, Nebraska, and he was suing for the right to vote, right? And so you understand why The Solicitor General, John Sowers, argued that certain children born on U.S. soil are, quote, subject to the jurisdiction of this country. You have to understand how the U.S. used that same exact logic to disenfranchise American people in this country for 150 years. Right? And so if you look at the, I'm on my Substack, I actually have a sort of a screen grab of the hearing that happened on the case before the Supreme Court, and the Justice Gorsuch, he asked Sauer, the Solicitor General, basically, do you think Native Americans are birthright citizens under your test, right? And Sauer answered, I think so. I have to think that through. And when Gorsuch, when he said, yes, they are because of statute, a law, right? Not because of birthright citizenship. And then Gorsuch said, well, without that statute. And then Sauer said, no, they are not. They are not. They would not be citizens, right? So that's a very important sort of thing I'm looking at in this hour. So, I wanted to maybe also take a look at the issue of the census, right, and John Elk, right, and take a look even further back to the let's look at John Elk, you know, and the Northwest Ordinance, just briefly, is that it was a law that was passed early in the Republic's history. It was sort of a law to dictate how territories or occupied lands would become territories and then become states, right? And so this was needed to basically annex the Northwest, what was then called the Northwest part of the United States, which is, of course, the area, the western area around the Great Lakes region and south of there, including Ohio and Michigan. And but it made Native people, this law made Native people invisible, right? And this is part of the start of this sort of legal erasure of Native people in this land. Well, it's not the start, but it's part of that whole history. And so enter John Elk, you know, in 1880. And, you know, he did everything, quote unquote, right. He left his reservation. He moved to Omaha and he paid his taxes, right? He argued no taxation without representation. Does that sound familiar to you, right? But, and of course, as I had gone over in the show before, you know, immigrants of any status in this country, they're paying taxes, right? They're paying into a system that they are not going to benefit from largely. And we all benefit from that, right? And we will not benefit if they are not allowed to do that, right? But in 1884, the Supreme Court told him, no, you were born under the jurisdiction of a sovereign nation. You are an alien in this land until we decide to grant you citizenship. So the 14th Amendment was a door locked from the inside, right? So white settlers feared a tribal block at the ballot box, and they still do. You know, I've covered this a lot in my writing, my reporting over the years, you know, all the ways which right now they're trying to prevent Native people from voting, especially in red states, because if you look at my different writing on different election cycles, these red states are actually kind of purple, right? The urban areas tend to vote Democratic, even in red states, and the rural areas vote Republican. But within that red area, there are these blue islands, and those are reservations, right? And many of these, you know, because of the number of votes that a candidate needs to win is actually quite small, right? Just sometimes even just a couple thousand, right? And reservations can provide that. And there are documented cases, several cases in which the votes in a red state by a tribe, by the tribal community, actually put a Democrat into the Senate, or even a Republican, like in Alaska, with Senator Murkowski, who ran without the support of her party, right? And so she is their senator, right? And and you'll see that these senators work together to really push the American Indian and tribe sort of agenda in D.C., right? And so they were afraid of the tribal bloc at the ballot. They did not want tribal citizens voting, right? And this was in Nebraska. And so they used the legal technicality of jurisdiction to keep Native people as ward subjects rather than citizen voters, right? And it's a really interesting case, actually, it's not related to this case, but somewhat related. When I was looking at the vote in Arizona, I did a very large in-depth piece on that in 2020. I traveled across Navajo Nation, and it was published by Sierra Magazine. And I found out that the Supreme Court in Arizona in the 1920s had actually decided that Native American Indian tribal citizens could not vote, right? Because they had the same status as because they were wards of the government, they equated this as being wards in the sense of wards of a mental institution, and so they were not fit to vote, right? It took really the Voting Rights Act in the like 60s, and even after that, it took quite a while for Native vote to actually happen in Arizona. And my grandparents, who were traditional Navajos who didn't speak English, I don't know how much. I know they voted a lot when they were older, but I don't know how much they voted later in life, because, of course, the elderly people on the reservation were very active politically at the Navajo Nation level, voting and stuff. So, of course, then they would vote at the federal and state level as well at those elections. So the case of John Elk, it basically established that citizenship was a gift, not a right, this case. So this is why it was being cited by Sauer in this Trump v. Barber case last week. Once again, in 1880, John Elk, a Winnebago man, did everything the assimilationist era demanded. He left his reservation, moved to Omaha, paid taxes, and lived as a resident of Nebraska. But when he tried to register to vote, he was denied, right? And so you have, but once again, the taxation without representation paradox. Elk's legal team argued that because he was subject to U.S. taxes and lived under U.S. law, the 14th Amendment birthright clause must apply to him. Of course, they are arguing that, these people are not immigrants, or their parents are not subject to jurisdiction in the United States, so therefore they don't deserve birthright citizenship, right? And so this is sort of why they're citing his case. So the Supreme Court's refusal in 1884, the court ruled in Elk v. Wilkins that Elk was not a citizen. Their reasoning, he was born under the jurisdiction of a sovereign nation. Therefore, he was an alien in the U.S. until the U.S. government chose to grant him citizenship through a specific act of Congress, right? And that didn't happen until the 1920s, after World War I, and I'll go into that a little bit later on. But so what we're seeing is, the ghost of this case being cited here today in 2026 by the Trump administration and DOJ. The court effectively ruled in 1884 that for Indians, the 14th Amendment wasn't a door that opened automatically. It was a door that was locked, to them from the inside. And so, and part of this was, and this was, part of the what the court was talking about was that it wasn't just about legal definitions; it was about demographic power. Right? There was a deep fear of the tribal bloc vote. And in the late 19th century, white settlers in the West feared that if Native people were granted the vote, they would vote as a sovereign bloc to protect land rights and treaty obligations. And the civilizing trap, that white politicians wanted Native people to pay taxes and own land. And of course, that goes to the Dawes Act, where, collectively owned tribal land was suddenly privately owned by individuals and was more easily taken from them and, becoming transferring it to white ownership, but they didn't want them to have the political power to defend that land at the ballot box. So by keeping Native people in a war status, the U.S. could exploit their resources while denying them a voice in the government that was taking them, right? And here we are, we have another situation of the taking of resources, right, of a person's work. I just heard in the news recently, I didn't read the article, but I did hear that that Trump is trying to basically has lowered the wages that farmers have to pay to migrant workers under a certain visa, and I know that the U.S. farm workers are fighting this because it would lower their wages as well. And so the reason he's doing this is because he's preventing migrants from coming to work here in the United States. Farmers are having to pay more for workers, right? And so And these farmers, of course, voted for this, right? They didn't, I didn't think this through or what the deal was. And call it if you have an idea why they're voting this way against their own interests, against their own workers, right? But now they did it both ways under Trump. They get to be this hard line on immigration, violence against many, many people, even U.S. citizens who look brown or who are defending brown people, brown and black people, and they make it to pay them less too, right? So this is a taking, and now they're trying to say that, you know, they can't have birthright citizenship if their children are born here. And so so the 2026 parallel we see with Trump, voter lists and pre-approval. I don't know if you've been following this, but Trump has been demanding a voter list even from Oregon. Oregon has been fighting that. And today in today's news cycle, and the Trump via Barber arguments, we're seeing the same mechanics of administration of exclusion being rebranded for the 21st century. And so you have a demand for voter lists, administration's demand for a detailed voter list, specifically targeting those with, quote, questionable birthright status. This mirrors the 1884 attempt to treat certain groups as, quote, aliens in their own land, right? It is a forensic hunt for a reason to say, you don't belong here, right? And so this pre-approved mail-in ballot, I heard that Trump just recently voted by mail-in ballot for Florida, but Trump is proposing that only pre-approved mail-in ballots be counted, right? So the administration is recreating this sort of barrier that John Elk faced in 1880. And so back in 1884, American Indians made a specific act of Congress to become citizens. Now here in 2026, the administration wants to require a specific stamp of approval for the state to exercise that citizenship. Right? So we're facing that now as well. And the right to vote, of course, is once again at the root of this, because the right to vote is the right to have a say about how things are done in this country. And so you have sort of targeted choke point, right? Just as the 1884 court used jurisdiction to basically, prevent John Elk from exercising his rights, these modern policies once again target what they call the chain of title, right? If you live on tribal land or an area with non-traditional addresses, and I covered this a lot in my reporting, that I mentioned earlier, and also in 2017-2018 elections, and in fact, there was a lot of attack at the state level. There still are by state legislatures to prevent Native communities for voting, and due to lack of infrastructure funding, many people know that reservations do not have adequate roads, they don't have electricity or water, and when I was covering the Bears Ears case in San Juan County in Utah, which has San Juan County is about the size of New Jersey, so it's a giant county, but more than half of the population is Navajo. And part of the county is within the border of the reservation. But they had gerrymandered Navajo voters into a single district, so they would never have a say about what was going on. But if you drive through that county, from north to south, you will quickly see, you'll start in the north and it'll be this completely modern sort of cities with everything, swimming pools and everything. And then as you go south to where Navajo people live, you have no paved roads, you have no electricity. I mean, it's just crazy, right? The settlers have everything, and the Native community, which is the majority, has nothing, right? And so they are weaponizing this against us by saying, well, you don't have addresses, because we don't, and you don't have, we don't have mail service either, largely. I went to a great deal of detail into mail service on the Navajo Nation in an article. And basically, there is no mail service to your home. You have to purchase a mailbox, and there are a limited number of mailboxes in any community. People basically have to inherit them when someone dies. And also, you may not be able to get a mailbox in your precinct, your voting precinct. So when you go to vote, your address does not match where you vote, where your voting precinct is, according to where you live, right? So this was the North Dakota legislature tried to do this back in 2017, and they passed the law. And the way the tribes there in North Dakota dealt with it was that they began assigning people addresses to use via their 911 address. But the Navajo Nation at the time in 2020 didn't have a 911 service on the reservation. Yes, we don't have any service on the reservation. I think there are only like 3 ambulances. And the Navajo Nation is the size of Ireland, okay? It's a big area. So no paved roads. Most people don't have electricity or water. You know, there are paved roads, but not where people live, right? Just the main roads, and no 911 service, right? And so we didn't have an option of doing that. So what Navajo voting rights activists were doing was that they were using Google address and using Google Maps addresses and helping people use that to determine what precinct they were in, because ballots were being rejected because they weren't in the precinct. Right? How would anyone know what the right precinct is if you don't have an address, right, for your actual where you live? And so there's all these ways in which they are preventing Native people to vote, right? And then, of course, I think the state of Arizona, I think, voted to outlaw ballot gathering, which is something that does happen on the Navajo Nation, where they'll go out and help elders, and they'll gather their ballots where they live, and then bring them in, right, and deliver them. And so they outlawed that as well. So anything to prevent Native people from voting, and the Navajo Nation has about almost 200,000 residents, and they vote 80% Democrat, right? And so that's a substantial number of voters that can really swing an election, and have swung elections in the state as well. So they're trying to prevent them from voting, So this pre-approval process that Trump is seeking will become a barrier that effectively disenfranchises many people without officially banning you from voting. So who knows how the process of approving people will actually be done. No idea. So let's bring this, I'm being a little long here with this sort of introduction, I apologize. So let's bring this to 2026, right? In the Trump v. Barber argument, there was this incredible exchange, and I just cited at the top of the hour, between Justice Gorsuch and John Sauer. And Gorsuch, you know, he is very respected in the Indian federal law field. He's actually the first Supreme Court justice to have any knowledge of Indian federal law. You don't have to know Indian federal law to pass the bar. It's not a requirement for, you know, law schools to even teach it, right? So many, many lawyers and judges don't know anything about Indian federal law, right? And I think I said this on the show before, but famously, I was told by Native lawyers that they were in a elevator with the late Justice what is his name? The guy, Alito. But yeah, he was. He basically told them that he didn't know Indian federal law, but he just made it up as he went along. And I'd like to believe that was a joke, but I think not. You know, this is someone who actually vociferously tried to fight for the sovereignty of Opus Dei, the Catholic sect, right? But he wouldn't fight for Scalia, Antonin Scalia, wouldn't fight for sovereignty for the sovereign nations with the United States, even though they're using our sovereignty as a reason not to grant us birthright citizenship, right? So anyway. So Gorsuch, who understands all of this much better than most, he pressed Solicitor General Sauer on this allegiance paradox, right? This sort of, as he said, do you think Native Americans are birthright citizens under your test? You know, this test that they're proposing via this case before the Supreme Court. If the administration succeeds in saying birth on the soil doesn't equal jurisdiction, they are reviving this argument that John Elk faced in 1884. But they are doing it to protect tribal sovereignty. No. They are doing it to recreate a sort of pre-approved class of citizens, right? And of course, as we know historically, that pre-approval really rests on whether you are, where your ancestors are from, and if they're from Europe, Northern Europe or not, right? And so, looking at the executive order that Trump signed last week regarding voter lists and mail-in ballots, the administration wants the U.S. Postal Service to only deliver ballots to pre-approved voters. So you won't even receive a ballot in the mail unless you've been pre-approved under this executive order. And Trump has denied that state voter lists perform citizenship audits, right? And so this is a modern digital version of the 1884 barrier. And so if you can't prove, you know, any of this to the state satisfaction, your 14th Amendment rights are going to be treated as a revocable privilege, right? Not a guaranteed or a privilege, a gift given by the state, and that can be taken away by any government, right, that has the mind to do it in the United States. And so, I definitely want to hear from you all. I should have put this number out earlier. The number here is 503-231-8187. And I guess my question to you is, how do we protect the right to vote when the state is trying to turn birthright into a selection bias tool? And for any of my American listeners, how do we defend our right to define our own citizenship without letting the U.S. government use our legal history as a weapon against others, right? And as I mentioned, I went to a deep dive in my piece. 1884 is calling the nativist attempt to weaponize American history on my Substack. And we are at a crossroads here where I would call it nativism. You know, this is nativism in a negative way, an attempt to narrow the 14th Amendment, which is a threat that faces all of us, and as far as voting and representation in this country today. So once again, the number is 503-231-8187. Please do call in. So I want to pivot now. One of the reasons, General Sauer, Solicitor General Sauer mentioned, his initial response to Justice Gorsuch was like, well, yes, Native Americans do have citizenship because of under statute, right? Under a law, not due to birthright citizenship. And so, and of course, Gorsuch pushed harder and was like, well, what if they didn't have that statute? And that's when Sauer had to admit that no, American Indians would not have citizenship in this country, right? So my citizenship is entirely based on this law, right, from 1924. And so I'm going to talk a bit about that law and the ties that my tribe, my dad's tribe, the Ancestry tribe, have to this particular law. And it's funny because so many people have never heard of the Yankton Sioux tribe, the Ahuntsic-One Dakota, one of the seven council fires of the Dakota Lakota Nation, the Ocheti Shekwan. Yankton tribal citizens have played a really big role in a lot of major issues before the courts and laws that really affect Native rights today. And that includes this Indian Citizenship Act of 1924, right? And so the story doesn't end with John Elk's exclusion there in Nebraska, you know, just across the border from the Yankee Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. It shifts in 1924 with the passage of the Indian Citizenship Act, right? It's important to understand that this wasn't just a spontaneous gesture of goodwill from Congress, right? No. It was earned through the blood of veterans and the relentless advocacy of women like Gertrude Simmons Thonon, also known as the Kalasha, right? And she was, Gertrude was a Yankton Dakota activist, right? And author, and she was a powerhouse, right? So she understood that without a vote, Native people had no shield against the land-grabbing policies of the era. She traveled the country, reminding Americans the very people whose land they occupied were the only ones denied a vote in its governance. And a lot of this follows the Great War, you know, World War One. And even though American Indians were not U.S. citizens, right, nearly 12,000 Native men served in World War One. And my own great-grandfather, Henry Keeler, and his identical twin brother, John, they served in the U.S. Air Service, which was the precursor to the modern Air Force. And you know, just imagine that they were helping keeping planes in the air in World War One when they were legally considered aliens to this country, right? And I did look at, and I was doing research, I did find news articles written about my great-grandfather and his identical twin brother. And you know, people were like amazed that they looked so alike. And there's a lot of stories about the Keeler twins. They did a lot of stuff that they played professional baseball. They started their own car sales company. Yeah, they drove well. Yeah, they were just very, they really worked together, do a lot of interesting things. And so, but when these men came home, they were forgotten. They had faced the horrors of the trenches in World War One, but they didn't have the same benefits, right? Because they weren't citizens, and they didn't have the veterans benefits that men they had served alongside had, right? And they were many of them very, very damaged by the war, right? And so the push for the 1924 Act was in many ways a response to this this terrible situation that Native veterans were facing after the war. And so, but at the same time, many tribes were very wary of this citizenship law. They worried this unilateral grant of citizenship as that might be a Trojan horse, right? And you'll still hear a lot of criticism in any country about this law and whether or not we want it whether we asked for it, whether citizenship was forced upon us. You will hear those arguments, right? And I'm not discounting them today, right, this morning. So they worry that it would be a way for the U.S. to finally dissolve tribal jurisdiction by making everyone just an American. Right. And it was a move to complete what the Northwest Ordinance started. Right. And I think I should probably talk a bit about the Northwest Ordinance, which was, of course, I think I mentioned this before, but the way in which a land that was being occupied would become a territory when they had like 5,000 white men residents. Right. And in voting, and then once they got to, what was it? Was it 50,000? But then they would become, they'd be able to apply to file papers to become a state, right? And so, and it did not include Native people, Native voters, potential Native folks living there. It only was applicable to white men, right? And so that was passed in 1787. And it was basically, it was actually adopted under the Confederation Congress, which was operating under the Articles of Confederation, and it created a method for admitting new states to the Union, right? Thomas Jefferson sort of oversaw the creation of that ordinance, and so, So they were worried that this would basically continue the disappearance of Native nations as sovereign nations. And to a certain extent, they are right. This did progress into the 1950s to the Termination Act, which I've discussed on this show before, which was passed by Congress in order to terminate the political status of tribes, and then was accompanied by the Relocation Act, which the purpose of was to relocate young people on the reservation to urban centers in the hopes to sort of depopulate the reservations, right, and to break the bounds between their citizens and the community, right? And so so this was not an idle worry, right? So they were worried about that, and they were worried it would basically culminate with the legal absorption of sovereign nations. And this is pretty much the goal of the federal government and particularly of states. States have always been antagonistic to the legal existence of of reservations and of tribes within their borders, and constantly fought to have some form of jurisdiction over the reservations, which they do not have, except for those that are that are under Public Law 280. A handful of states have Public Law 280 reservations, but tribes can petition to get out of that situation. And so I think the Yakima Nation was a Public Law 280 there in Washington State, and they got out of that. Washington State did have Public Law 280 reservations, one of the states that did that. And so, but most states have no say over what happens within reservation boundaries. That's sovereign territory of what they call us domestic dependent nations under the Supreme Court lingo. And so they really dislike that. Of course, the most recent case that cited that was, of course, the McGirt case, right? And tribes were not expecting to win that case. But surprisingly, this was a ruling in 2020, McGirt versus Oklahoma, before the Supreme Court. But it ruled that, that the land reserve for the Muscogee Creek Nation had never been disestablished in Oklahoma and remains Indian country under federal law, meaning Oklahoma cannot prosecute Native Americans for crimes committed on that land. This decision reaffirmed tribal sovereignty and impacts how major crimes involving Native Americans are handled legally in Oklahoma. And this applied not only to the Muscogee Creek Nation, but also to the other tribes that were settled there, the five civilized tribes that were settled there, removed from their homelands and sent to Indian territory there in the 1800s. And so it's caused, you know, of course, Oklahoma does not like this. Even the Cherokee Nation citizen, Mark Wayne Mullen, who was a senator from Oklahoma, he was not a big supporter of this. He is now, of course, replaced Kristi Noem as the Interior Secretary, right? And I suppose you could say he's the second American Indian citizen to be the Secretary of the Interior after Deb Haaland, who is Laguna Pueblo and a former congresswoman from New Mexico. And but, of course, he's a very different sort of tribal citizen, right? He's Republican. He's a huge Trump supporter. And he is not that blood quantum matters, mind you. And the Cherokee Nation does not use blood quantum for citizenship. You just need to have an ancestor who was on the Dawes rolls, right? Mark Wayne Mullen meets the standard, but he is by blood only 1/512th Cherokee. Yeah, 512th Cherokee. So it is not a big. You know, I don't know. He has a lot of other folks in his tree that are not Cherokee, you know. And I think that may actually reflect in his politics as well. Although I think that there are a lot of Republican Cherokees. There's a lot of Republican Indian people in Oklahoma. And the deciding vote on this was actually Justice Neil Gorsuch. And this was one of his first major cases. And this is where the tribes really began to value his knowledge of Indian federal law, and began to realize they had an advocate on the bench there in the Supreme Court. So this is the way in which, just illustrating how tribes and states, how they're at odds with each other, and so this continues to this day. This desire to sort of limit the ability of tribal citizens and tribal nations to have any say in this country about what happens. And this 1924 Act, as I mentioned before, is exactly why that exchange between Justice Gorsuch and Solicitor General John Sauer last week was so concerning to me, right? So when Gorsuch was asked point blank if American Indians would still be considered citizens under the Trump administration's new restrictive birthright rationale, Sauer had to pivot. He didn't claim our citizenship was a constitutional right under the 14th Amendment. Instead, he argued that our citizenship is protected by statute, specifically the 1924 Indian Citizenship Act. And so this is the reason why this is not very comforting to me, right? Is because it raises this rather terrifying question, right? you know, if our citizenship is merely statutory, right, what happens if a Trump-aligned Congress decides to repeal that statute, right? If your citizenship is not anchored in the Constitution, it only is as strong as the current political whim in Washington, D.C., right? And if that law is repealed, we're instantly thrown back to 1884 L.T. Wilkins standard, aliens in our own land without a legal home in the American body politic. That's where myself and hundreds of thousands of other American Indians would be, right? And so, and of course, as I mentioned earlier, there are tribal citizens who might say, good, right? Let tribal citizens be paramount, right? Let us return to being solely citizens of our own nations, right? And while that is a powerful vision of decolonization, right, we have to be honest about the material reality that we face today in 2026 as tribal nations, right? Our nations have systemically been underfunded, as I mentioned earlier, and under-resourced, right, for centuries now, right? And to be suddenly thrust onto the world stage without a U.S. passport, without recognized international standing, and with a hostile administration in D.C., the most powerful government in the world, ready to treat us as foreign entities on our own mineral-rich lands. And we see what they're doing to sovereign nations with mineral-rich lands, right? We see that happening right now in Iran and Venezuela, right? It's a recipe for catastrophe, right? And so we're being set up for a jurisdictional no man's land. And this is why defending this 1924 statute, as controversial as it has been, even in Indian country, right? The work of, you know, another Yankton Sioux woman, Gertrude Simmons Bonin, and the 14th Amendment, it just isn't just about assimilation, it's about survival. Right, and that's how I feel it to be when I hear them talking about us. Never ever seems like a good thing, right? And I didn't touch on this, but I did touch on this in my article on Substack, which is also the questions that were raised by Justice Barrett, Justice Amy Barrett, right? Her line of questioning about the bubble of sovereignty, right? The bubble of sovereignty surrounding tribal nations. And my take, and I am not a lawyer, I have taken Indian federal law classes, but I am not a lawyer, is that the Justice Barrett, I mean, on one hand, was she challenging the theory that would essentially allow the court to update the 14th Amendment by creating new modern-day exceptions to citizenship, right? Or was she testing it, right? Which would be more concerning, right? So when she asked the ACLU, Cecilia Wang, whether changed circumstances, i.e. if the relationship between tribes and the federal government were in flux, would this mean that the court should reevaluate our constitutional status? She's talking about American Indians, right? And I definitely see that argument as a danger, because while this concept of a living constitution is a healthy part of our democracy, it changes when changes to it are being proposed for exclusionary rather than inclusionary reason, it could be a direct threat to the legal standing of our Native nation, right? And to each of us tribal citizens vis-a-vis the United States. So the court is set to rule in June. Both Gorsuch and Barrett have played pivotal roles in Indian country cases before. As I mentioned, for Gorsuch's rule in McGirt v. Oklahoma, and Barrett's role in Holland v. Brackeen, a case dealing with the Indian Child Welfare Act, which she voted on the side of the tribes, right? So the central question now is whether the court will uphold the Constitution's promise of inclusive citizenship or allow these nativist efforts to redefine who is truly American in this country. And so that is my question to you. I know that it's been pretty quiet out there, but I'll throw the number out there one more time to call in. The number here is 503-231-8187. I know it's been a lot of sort of put on you, all of you guys, but yeah, please do call in and let me know what you think about this threat to birthright citizenship. And just to summarize, John L. paid his taxes in 1880, but the Supreme Court told him his birthright didn't count because he owed allegiance to a sovereign nation, right? Today we see a version of that same gatekeeping. And when the administration demands a pre-approved list and challenges the 14th Amendment, they are trying to bring back the 1884 standard, right, where citizenship isn't a right you're born with, but a privilege that the state can choose to withhold. So this is why looking at Gorsuch's questions and also Justice Barrett, the questions last week, it proves that the ghost of the past from the 1880s is really quite dangerous even today, right? And so even though maybe voter law is not a part of constitutional law that is generally taught or required to know, it seems to play an oversized role, an outsized role in sort of determining what's happening today with very fundamental rights like citizenship, right? So, it's still pretty quiet, and I understand that this is a lot of information to take in at once. And I do ask you to think about these issues, and you can go to my Substack, Jacqueline Keeler's newsletter, and you can look at my article 1884 calling, and I have those are the same arguments, and also I have a lot of different links to a deeper dive to the paper trail, right, the legal paper trail. So we've got the primary legal documents and cases, the 14th Amendment, Elk v. Wilkins, United States, also discussed with United States v. Wong Kim Ark, which was a landmark case that affirmed the SOE, right of the soil for the children of non-citizens, while notoriously leaving the Indian exception intact. So the 1898 ruling kept the Indian exception there, and that was not changed until the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924, the federal statute that finally granted citizenship to all American Indians, correcting the gap left by the 14th Amendment. And then also I have links to the oral arguments and also background and context, including McGirt v. Oklahoma and Holland v. Brackeen, and also some related research, because I also brought up in the piece I wrote, the 1862 Dakota Uprising in Minnesota, also known as the Dakota War. And I discussed this before on my shows and my writing about that, particularly since Dakota people and Ojibwe people as well in Minnesota have been facing violence by ICE because they are not being regarded as citizens again, right? And some of them, one young Dakota woman was actually physically taken from her car and taken to Fort Snelling, which is where her Dakota ancestors were held, right? That was a concentration camp of the winter of 1862 to 1863. Hundreds of Dakota people died there, and until they were put on boats in the spring and shipped off to the Crow Creek Reservation in South Dakota, right near Pierre, right in the middle of the state, they were taken away from their homeland and sent there. And so we have been removed from our homelands, like the folks in Oklahoma, much farther, though they were removed much farther from their homelands. But Minnesota, to this day, there is a federal law saying that Dakota people are not allowed in the state, and that they can actually, they issued bounties for our body parts if we go there and stuff. So that is still active law in the state. But I think I really share the ways in which none of this is new. Why is this still a thing? So that's my question I'm going to go out with today. But I wanted to thank you all for listening. I think maybe sometimes it seems like I'm drawing a big connection here, but when we're actively discussing the Supreme Court, I would like to address that and understand why it matters today. So I do encourage you to check out my links. I have other things I've written about in depth on my newsletter, which you can also check out at your leisure, including things about the Dakota Sioux Uprising. And of course, I had written an article about it for the San Francisco Chronicle in last month. And so we're going to figure it out. Anyway, so I wrote a new death piece there as well about it. So please check that out. So thank you so much. We're wrapping up this hour of Wednesday Talk Radio. And we looked at the Hormuz Tolls, of course, the Northwest Ordinance, the Ghost of John Elk, And it's been a lot to go through. Thank you for listening and joining me today. And I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday Talk Radio. And we'll probably take a closer look at what's going on with the truth, you know, whether the truth is holding or not. Trump is very volatile, so it may be completely different by tomorrow. And we'll discuss that. So once again, I'm Jacqueline Keeler. Thank you for listening and for, I know it was quiet, I can't say for calling in, but thank you for listening and for standing for rights of all U.S. All people, you know, regardless of where they come from, for citizenship. And stay tuned for more KU programming this today. So thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Earth Day is around the corner. Celebrate with KBOO at our Earth Day tree planting open house, April 22nd, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mingle with other Earth-conscious radio heads, enjoy snacks and drinks, and become